All right, so what I'm going to talk about is exploring mathematical cosmology with numerical simulation. This is a long-term project started by Vince and me at ITP in 1993, and more details can be found in this paper. Other collaborators are David Garfinkel, Jim Eisenberg, and Marcia Weaver. After a very brief introduction, sort of telling you what this means, I'm going to emphasize two aspects, and although I've written them sequentially, I'll be emphasizing them at the same time. And these are, what did we learn from doing this, basically? And the other, in light of the purpose of this workshop, how our problem can be useful for testing various numerical algorithms, because what cosmology just means is cosmological boundary conditions to solution signs, signs equations. Singularity theorems say that regular initial data will generically develop singularities, but don't provide any information about the singularity. However, there's a long-standing argument by Belinsky, Kolatnikov, and Lifshitz that the approach to the singularity is characterized by local mixmaster dynamics. What this means is that if you start out, and the singularity is at the bottom here somewhere, with your space-time grid on the computer, with Einstein's equations, and you can evolve the full set of PDEs, or, according to the BKL claim, after you evolve for a while, the spatial derivatives, which link nearby points, will become dynamically unimportant, and each spatial point will evolve as if it were governed by the ODEs of a homogeneous cosmology, and generically, that cosmology will be in the mixmaster class. We use numerical simulations of Einstein's equations to test this, these claims, and these claims are presumably valid for all solutions which develop singularities in some sense. I'll make a remark on that later. But we consider cosmological spacetimes in particular because of the simple boundary conditions. And so far in our simulations, we've considered systems with only one spatial killing field, which are 2 plus 1 simulations, or 2, which are 1 plus 1 simulations. And so let me just say a little bit about homogeneous cosmologies. We really only have to know about two types. The first is the Kasner solution, which is a vacuum spatially homogeneous cosmology characterized by three anisotropic scale factors which obey power law and proper time. And the powers are restricted by these two expressions, which means that if you evolve toward the singularity, there'll be two collapsing directions and one expanding direction, and the expansion rates stay fixed for all time. We'll be talking about the mini superspace picture, which regards the evolution of this model as occurring in a dynamical space where the directions denote the values of the anisotropy and volume, and it looks like a free particle. And so the Kasner model is the free particle in this dynamical system. And the Hamiltonian constraint, in fact, restricts the time derivatives of the anisotropy. So P plus and P minus are the time derivatives of two shears, and this is the Hubble constant squared, and the Hamiltonian constraint provides this restriction. And because it's a free particle, you can then solve the problem. The anisotropy grows linearly as the volume. This is the log of the volume. It goes to minus infinity, it's a singularity. Okay. Now, what about mixed master models? There, instead of spatially flat system, we have some sort of curved three space. In particular, this is Bianchi 9 that I've written down. We could use Bianchi 8. We could add matter to Bianchi 1 or 6-0. They're all sorts of mixed master systems, but they're all characterized in the following way. In the mini superspace picture, we have the free particle Hamiltonian plus some exponentials. Okay. And the exponentials are, in fact, functions of the volume and anisotropies, and the system acts as a free particle, that is a Kasner solution. Then, in these variables, when the argument of the exponential is approximately zero, instead of being exponentially small, it's of order unity, a bounce occurs, changing one Kasner or fixed set of collapse rates into another fixed set. And this presumably goes on indefinitely. And if one assumes that the Kasner solution is correct, it is easy to show that if you plug it back in, plug the Kasner solution for beta plus or minus into these arguments of the exponentials, one of them must always grow. Okay. So that even when you're in here in the free particle Kasner regime, the system will always be heading towards a growing exponential potential. And the physics, then, is just the bounce off an exponential potential, which you can actually compute exactly, and you can generate bounce rules just by noticing that the momentum changes sign in the bounce. Now, if one does a numerical simulation of a mixed master model, one sees the following picture. This is one of the anisotropies. This is absolute value of omega as a time. The Kasner phase is a straight line. Every time there's a bounce, that is, you change from one Kasner to another, one of the three exponential potentials, that's these terms, grows. Okay, so it's this picture of the growing exponential potentials with Kasner behavior in between that we're going to use to characterize what happens in spatially inhomogeneous cosmologies. And just to complete things, let me show you a blue movie for Thibault, which shows a simulation of about 260 bounces using, by the way, David Garfinkel's super mixmaster algorithm. So we're evolving toward the singularity in this model. Now, for spatially inhomogeneous models, we're going to use numerical simulations and look for behavior which is either close to a different Kasner model at every spatial point, which we call asymptotically velocity term dominated, or to a sequence of Kasner models at every spatial point, which is characterizes an oscillatory approach to singularity, which may or may not be the hypothesized local mixmaster dynamics. And we use an analytic method of consistent potentials, which is precisely how I said we understood the mixmaster model itself, to try to organize the data and predict the behavior. And then I will also, along the way, show you how we can test various numerical algorithms. Now, this is a status report. I'll read through it. This is a status report on mathematical in blue, numerical in red, studies of approaches to singularity in inhomogeneous cosmologies. Some of the mathematical studies are proofs, and some are incomplete proofs, and I'll let the authors of those studies explain that all to you. Okay, there's a proof that polarized Gaudi is asymptotically velocity term dominated by Eisenberg and Moncrief. Then there were numerical studies of generic Gaudi models, which I'll talk about later, by us. And then a proof by Kitchen, Asami, and Rendell that solutions of the type we found existed. Is that fair enough? Okay. And then Eisenberg and Kitchen, Asami showed that polarized twisted Gaudi, which I'll tell you what that is a little later, it's a generalization of Gaudi, which I'll also explain, is velocity dominated. Then a numerical demonstration that magnetic Gaudi is locally mixed master by Marcia Weaver in her thesis. Then we have an ongoing project for the general twisted Gaudi models. Our numerical proof, well, we can see from the simulations that the system is oscillating from one cabinet to another. We have some evidence, which I'll show later, that in fact the changes are mixed master dynamics, but we don't have that nailed down quantitatively. Okay. Then there's a work in progress, where the paper is being written, proving that these models are velocity term dominated. A numerical study, and then this amazing proof of the general no symmetry Einstein equations with scalar field or stiff fluid by Anderson and Rendell. Now, you'll notice one thing. The mathematical studies are all operating in the locally Kasner-like models, and they can't handle this yet. And then I like to think that perhaps some of this mathematical work was inspired at least by some of the things we found in the numerical studies. And I think there's a strong interplay now between both ways of looking at this topic.
The last thing was compensated by some of the people who have
like the That's right, but what they did was they have theorems.
Yes, no, I understand.
Yeah, right, right. I'm right. This
but
is
they were inspired by looking at the very terms and you could see.
Right. Right, I agree that this everything you see here is entirely consistent with BKL's framework and predictions and what they say.
Coming back to the blue movie, I want to know, so this was real simulation of the evolution of the ODE.
Right, right.
Now, how well does this evolution reproduce the collision load of the Lewis-Parasikov?
To machine precision. Provided that early in the simulation, if you use a correct, you have to generalize the law. No.
Okay, they are very precise collision laws.
No, that in fact you can.
Come back on the collision law.
Right. Right. To machine precision. In fact, you can see where you lose the original information, and you can see the difference between double precision and quadruple precision. Now, I can show you some pictures of that, which I did not put in this talk. Yeah? Yeah? Right. Right. Now, you know, there is the exception of going into the corners. But you do come back. And then there have been some recent analytic results, which don't quite yet get at that completely, but get close. Okay, so let me talk a little bit about the method of consistent potentials originally developed by Grubesich and Moncrief, but we've applied them to these models. And the idea is to just make a formal use of the idea of local Kasner behavior interspersed by exponential bounces. This is in the spirit of BKL's original approach, but I think a lot simpler. So the idea... No, they did more. We're doing less than they did. That's right. But if you look in detail, at what they did, the detail difference is that they actually try to solve what I would call the Gaudi equations instead of the Kasner equations. So they make it harder for themselves than they need to. Okay. So what we do is, what one can do is neglect all terms arising from spatial dependence. That gives you a system of ODEs, which in the limit at the time variable goes to infinity, which is where the singularity is supposed to be. If you've chosen variables conveniently, then you should obtain velocity term dominated equations, which have the linear Kasner-like behavior with spatially dependent coefficients. You then substitute that solution into the full Einstein equations. If the terms you left out, in fact, are exponentially small, then the velocity term dominated solution is consistent, and you then predict that the system will be asymptotically velocity term dominated. The terms which are not exponentially small actually act as potential to drive the system in the dynamical behavior, and then we compare the prediction to what we get in the simulations. So as a first example, we'll look at Gaudi models. These are models which depend on a single spatial variable, theta, time tau, tau equal infinity is the singularity in these variables. The P is related to the amplitude of the plus polarization of gravitational waves. Q is related to the amplitude of the cross polarization. I'm assuming that the spatial topology is the three torus. There are other Gaudi models, and I'll come to one a little later. And the nice thing is that the equations for P and Q decouple from the background variable lambda. That means that you don't have to worry about solving the constraints. The initial data is essentially arbitrary. There's a little bit of restriction due to the topology. And then if you... Excuse me, I did this too fast. The 2 should be out here. Okay.
And there should be a plus. This is the same metric. There is no sign in front of this line.
Oh. I'm sorry. I just did this too quickly. Yeah, a plus here and the 2 here.
And geometrically, can you see that keep each time I read one of these papers and understand for finding it from Gaudi, and then I keep forgetting it again? Can you define Gaudi?
Okay. Yeah, it's Einstein-Rosen waves with interchanging space and time, basically. Okay. To make a all right. So this common factor, e to the minus tau, is the area. So there's a scaling of the area in the symmetry plane down to zero, and then if you assume P and Q are small, let's say, and then expand these exponentials, you find that you get a polarization tensor multiplied basically by P times the plus polarization, Q times the minus polarization, and then all of this propagates in a background space-time that has lambda in it. So There are two killing vectors in the sigma and delta direction. Okay, well, these are commuting. Yeah. G2, what do I mean? No, they have the same number of variables, but you don't get this decoupling.
Okay.
So, okay.
And the polarized is going
to polarized is Q is zero.
In which case the switching vector are also not possible.
No, it's just the same. There's just okay. Thank you. Okay, the wave amplitudes can be obtained from the variation of. So lambda is. Set, these are first order equations. This is the Hamiltonian constraint, and this is the theta momentum constraint. And what this means is that you can forget you ever heard of these, solve these, obtain P and Q, and then go back and construct lambda at your leisure. In the general case, the in these variables, the where the twists come back, so you lose this extra symmetry that Alan mentioned, there are off-diagonal terms present, namely all possible ones. In these variables, you need shifts and all kinds of things. But what it has the effect of doing is mixing the dynamics so that you can't make this nice separation.
And the tau variable, when you define the...
So e to the minus... 2 tau is the area in the symmetry, is the magnitude, multiplies the area in the symmetry plane. So tau goes to infinity is the singularity. Okay? Yes. I'm sorry. I was too asleep when I did this. It says Q dot Q prime. All right, so the wave equations can be obtained by the variation of this Hamiltonian, which is not the Hamiltonian constraint. I showed you the Hamiltonian constraint below. The velocity term dominated solution has the limiting behavior that P is linear in tau and everything else is constant where the coefficients depend on theta. That is, it's a different Kasner-like model at every spatial point. And you can relate this behavior to the Kasner model directly if you want to. Okay. Now, there are a couple of exponential terms in the Hamiltonian. And if the system is asymptotically velocity term dominated, then these potentials must be exponentially small. So here's one of them. If we substitute back the velocity term dominated result for P and Q, we see this behavior in the exponential. And in order for it to decay exponentially, V has to be positive at every spatial point. The other exponential term says that this combination has to be negative, which means that V has to be less than 1. For it to be exponentially small. So so that there is a consistent range for asymptotically velocity term dominated behavior, but it implies restrictions on this variable V. And so the question becomes, what happens if the system is not in that range? V is P dot, right. So here are the two exponential potentials, and we see that the system gets driven back and forth between the two, each time getting closer to the consistent range. If the potential terms aren't there, or their coefficients are very small, then you can have growth of spiky features, as we call them. This would be the potential on the right being very small, so that P continues to the right and gets very big. The velocity V stays large. Here, the potential on the left is very small. P can become large and negative, and it's easy to show that that leads to this funny structure in Q. No, this is generic. The numerical types, I want to show a feature of these models, again, typical models, that comes into play if you want to study things like convergence. And that's the fact that these spiky features are very narrow, and they physically get narrower with time. Because right at the center of these features is a point where the potential is exactly zero, and at that point, one does not get the generic behavior. And as you evolve toward the singularity, all the other points will turn around. You know, at all the other points, the system will turn around. And what that means is that with inadequate resolution, you can't model the spiky features. So at any fixed time, there is a resolution such that at finer resolutions than that, you get everything converges. But that resolution won't be good enough at a later time, well, closer to the singularity. All right. In these models, they actually are fixed, eventually. They move early on, but they freeze out. That's the property of the velocity term-dominated behavior. And so this is just a portion, different portions of the graph, and you see that if eventually we would reach a resolution where they'd all fall on top of each other, but before that, you don't quite get the right behavior, but it seems to know about it in some sense. I'll come back to that with U1 models. Now, at a typical spatial point in a generic one of these models, one can follow the time derivative of P, which, remember, is supposed to end up in the range between 0 and 1. And here's how it does it. These are the two potentials bouncing around. And we see that here the slope is negative. There's a bounce off V1. The slope becomes positive, but it's too high, so there's another bounce off V2, and so on until the slope falls into the allowed range and the potentials decay away. This is a logarithmic scale, and they never come back. Now I'm going to show you the movies I actually showed a couple of weeks ago. This is to remind you. This dashed line is a comparison of the symplectic differencing and symplectic derivatives and differencing, just to remind you of an example where you can use these models to study different algorithms. But anyway, this is generically what P of theta will look like. So you start forming these spiky features, and they freeze in space and grow narrower, and this would just continue indefinitely. Yeah, this is because this is this particular movie is an overlay of standard differencing and symplectic differencing. Spectral differencing. Okay. So this was just the example I showed a couple weeks ago when I guess you weren't here, just to show that you can use these models and that you can these features are independent of algorithm. And this is a spiky feature in Q forming. Now keep that in mind. Okay, in particular, the way this guy just rose straight up, because I'm going to show you some movies using David Garfinkel's code. He decided to test his axis algorithm by doing Gaudi models on S2 cross S1. So these are essentially the same model as before, but we're using the theta angle on the S2 as our theta. And you'll see effects early in the simulation from the topology, but eventually, messed it up. Hit the wrong place. So after sloshing around for a while, start forming identical spiky features. And in his paper, David looked at the behavior at given points in terms of our understanding of the Gaudi models on T3 and discovered the same behavior. So I'm not showing you that. I'm just showing you that the shape looks the same.
And are the edges of what we see there?
That's right. Yeah, the edges of the poles. Let me show you Q, which is a little more striking. You start seeing, for some reason, that line doesn't reproduce. There's a straight line all the way out there. And again, you see the same kind of discontinuity eventually. Early on, you see what are essentially boundary conditions because they're restrictions on the behavior of the functions at the poles for regularity. And so early on, the effect of the topology is visible. Later, it's not. So somebody want to see it again?
Yes.
Okay. You see some side-to-side motion. That's the effect of the boundary conditions. I mean, it's topology, but it contributes boundary conditions. Yeah.
So presumably each point is doing a definite evolution in the
whole. Right, but not during the whole simulation. That's the asymptotic state. So early on, it knows about global conditions, but eventually it doesn't.
Why doesn't your plot look like it began batting after time? Wouldn't each point be kind of move with some velocity, or would it scale kind of?
No, it. Okay. What happens the local Kasner solution has the property that at a fixed theta p increases linearly. Yes, it does. Yeah, it is, but I stopped at some point. The velocity is small. It's between 0 and 1 when it becomes velocity dominated. Tau goes up to about 25 only in this. No, it shouldn't. I mean,
intuitively, one would get the impression that the plot should do all sorts of things, but kind of move upward.
Yeah.
Maybe it's just a scale.
Well, I think it really is doing that. If I ran longer, it would do that. we're seeing different things, I guess, looking at the same thing. It doing what it's supposed to. If we ran it longer. No, the scale of tau is 25. The scale of P, I don't remember. It's about 10. Yeah. Right, but I haven't. What would happen after an infinite amount of time is that these spiky features would continue to narrow and at some point become invisible because of the plotting. Okay. Everywhere else, it would move very slowly up, except this one here. These here will eventually turn around because it has to be positive. Yeah. 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 P equals zero is probably around there. I could check afterwards. I don't remember.
Like, the drawing on the hyperbolic plane, because this is a plane on hyperbolic plane.
Right.
And then what does it do on the hyperbolic plane? You go down for the time.
The point should be as entire to approaching a geodesic with some E, which is like a fixed location. I guess that's B.
Yeah.
So it should be a
loop of geodesic.
By each individual point approaches and gives us at the speed V, which varies from point.
That would be a good visual thing to keep our you've
had pictures of P dot, I
yeah.
P is what we call it, but I mean, they do, I think.
That's right. That's right. I haven't explored this model. This is what David has looked at, so he has studied. I just made the evolution. Huh? No, he has looked in detail.
I think it's interesting that you have a plot of P against Q rather than P against Q dot Q against Q to see what the shape would be in the hyperbolic plane.
Okay. Well, it's an infinite dimensional plot. At a given point, or what? Okay, yeah, that would be no problem. Okay, no problem. You want to see this movie again, too? Okay. As I said, the line is really there. I don't know why. I'm looking. I don't know why it doesn't come through in the movie, but it's there. And there's finer scale structure all through here. So these are just the gross features. And it's just the same kind of spike. And these spike features are associated with these here because they occur whenever T is negative. I guess the zero line is about there. Now, the first way that we generalized the Gaudi model with adding a magnetic field that, so there should be an amplitude of a magnetic field here. Some of my guests have it, some don't. So this is the original Gaudi here, but we put back the momentum associated with the background variable, which in the vacuum Gaudi model was just a constant equal to a half. Here it becomes dynamical because lambda appears in the coupling to the magnetic field whose amplitude should be written here but isn't. Okay. Now, this creates an extra potential term. The behavior of the velocity term dominated solution is the same as before. We just redefined V. Remember, this denominator was constant before. And then lambda goes as minus V squared times tau, the same V. Pi lambda does go to a constant. So similar behaviors before, but when you plug lambda in, you see that precisely for the allowed range that you had before, this new term will grow. And so you get the interplay, if you look at a simulation of this model, an interplay of the three potentials, so that when the slope is small, which is where you would stop in a vacuum Gaudi model, the new potential term rises to cause a bounce to make the potential big again. You then get a bounce off the curvature here, and so on. The problem was we couldn't do and so on numerically, but presumably that's what happened. Then the twisted Gaudi models, the previous one is McMaster. That happens to be an inhomogeneous generalization of magnetic Bianchi 6-0, which is one of the McMaster models. This is the same sort of thing with a different term. And it has the same kind of effect, but with different bounce rules. And we're not really sure what this is right now. It's also very delicate numerically. And if your code can handle this, which ours could if we did enough resolution, I believe, you would you could see which might be a better differencing algorithm. Okay. So in all of these, I'm going to show P of theta T from the same initial data. This one and this one will also have the same time variable per frame. This one, each frame will be twice as long. And I think I'll show them sequentially. Okay, so this is a different Gaudi from the one I showed you before with the same sort of behavior. And you see it just freezes and rises just the way you'd expect. Yeah. Well, all the velocities are between 0 and 1, so.
So that works about the same over the course.
Yeah, if you look, you know, if you look at each individual spatial point, they look right. I mean, you know, that there'll be particular differences between one model and another, but the generic behavior is the same. Now, magnetic starts out the same and then starts not doing much, and then all of a sudden it starts bouncing around. And this stuff is numerical noise, some of this. Okay.
That one is expected to be spatiotemporal fields, right? Each point is bouncing around the other.
Yeah, if you could, well, let me say a remark about that for a minute. Okay. And this one goes wild and is the hardest to model. In Mixmaster itself, in the time variables we're using, each epoch is roughly exponentially longer than the one before. Okay? So, initially in these models, you get a lot of bouncing around, but then the interval between bounces increases. So you stop getting a lot of bouncing around. That doesn't mean if you couldn't follow it infinitely far, you wouldn't see an infinite number of bounces. Now, we can do that essentially in Mixmaster itself because we have an algorithm that can give us an exponentially increasing time step, but we can't do that in these models.
How many bounces will it happen to you before then?
Yeah. No. Not as far as our method of consistent potential says it should not be. And that's what we're finding. Yeah, it's this extra coupling between the background. But we don't fully understand that model. Now, I want to say a few words about expanding Gaudi models. Other people have used these as code tests. And it's not, in my mind, a rigorous code test because it doesn't have any spiky features. We're using a different time variable, which goes to infinity more naturally. So this is t goes to zero at the singularity. And Vince and I have been working on this problem. And we believe that eventually t and q have this rather, are dominated by their homogeneous modes. And these things are basically the asymptotic expansions of Bessel functions, where the numerators are these oscillatory pieces of the Bessel functions. And this can have either sign if there's no homogeneous mode in Q.
So, sorry, this is the thing which is Kasner-like.
Yeah, toward the singularity, it's Kasner-like. Away from the singularity, what I'm going to claim is that it really goes linear. You don't get strong nonlinear effects. You just get basically oscillations of each polarization. These are the plus and cross polarizations of the gravitational waves. They basically just oscillate on their own with this overall time dependence scaling away the amplitudes.
Where am I supposed to see oscillations?
The oscillations are in alpha and zeta, which I haven't written there. Remember, the Bessel function as a function of t plus the wave in theta. Okay, so you have some sort of shape in theta, which let's say some superposition of cos and theta or something, multiplied by the oscillatory behavior of the Bessel functions, which is a cos and t in these variables. And so you have products of sines and cosines, which gives you some overall sine and cosine plus a phase, vaguely. And so that's these things. So it depends on exactly which modes you have, so I can't really write it down.
But what does it mean to us to think that time after time is in t, divided by time or lower than t goes to zero, and one should extend?
No, t is going to infinity. This is late time.
Ah, you are going reverse.
Yeah, yeah. Expanding Gaudi model. Okay.
Okay, but that's physical.
What? I'm not. Right, but we don't have any matter. These are vacuum solutions, okay? And so anyway, this is P for an expanding model, and you'll see it do something, and the amplitude decays, and then it just sort of oscillates around. And then Q also has a decaying amplitude and an overall decay, and then sort of oscillates around.
So I can think that these plots the same as before, but now we do the time evolution.
Right. That's right. That's right. But the point is that my argument is that, and again, this is time going up this way. This is the whole spatial domain. The change in colors are the oscillations. Here, there's an overall change in shape for this model. And if we look at the homogeneous mode of P and Q, where we have a feeling for what they should do, Q decays, and P has these oscillations which are disappearing, which show the decrease of coupling to the rest of the dynamics. The homogeneous mode should depend only, should just have this parallel logarithmic behavior, and any oscillations come because we're coupling to higher frequency modes, and that should decay as shown by the decreasing amplitude here. And when we use our we fit our expressions for the shape of the homogeneous mode to these observed behavior, it seems to fit very well. So I think we're not really done with this analysis, but I think there's something to it. Okay. Yeah, right. A homogeneous solution. You can prove that. Right.
The circumference of the geometrical circumference of the string is measured in the hyperbolic metric, shrinks to zero for a general gravity solution. That's something that we don't have to do.
Okay. So now I want to move on to U1 symmetric cosmologies, where it's conceivable I even wrote the metric down right. Okay. So here we have variables C, lambda, X, and Z, which depend on two spatial variables and time. And then these twists are eliminated. There are two of these, which are eliminated in favor of a single twist potential, omega, which can be done because of the U1 symmetry. And first, we have to try to understand what the if there were a local mixmaster dynamics in these models, which is what we predict, what would it look like? And I'm showing this first. In fact, we found this afterwards. So this is a standard mixmaster numerical evolution toward the singularity. These are the scale factors. This region here is blown up here. And we see what we have are oscillations between two scale factors. While one of them decreases monotonically, then that one comes back and starts oscillating, and this one decays, and so on. And this presumably continues forever. This is vacuum Bianchi 9. This is a homogeneous. This is a homogeneous vacuum Bianchi 9 model evolved toward the singularity, and these are the logarithms of the three scale factors. That's right. I'm not going to argue it. You may call it what you wish. Okay. Superposed on this is the U1 variable phis. So it's possible to write a homogeneous mixmaster model as if it were a U1 model by writing out the spatial one forms. One of the spatial coordinates is appears as a killing vector in the as a manifest killing vector in the one form. That is, the coefficients don't depend on it. Choose that to be the U1 killing field, and then you can identify the variables. So that's what I'm doing here. I'm just saying what the U1 variables look like in terms of standard mixmaster, or BKL or Bianchi 9 or whatever you want to call it, in terms of these scale factors. Okay. So,
this is a typical spatial point. You know, you kind of lose the apparent homogeneity of that.
That's right.
What those functions look like at a typical spatial point. Right. Secretly, everything's
homogeneous. Right. But they look. The spatial dependence comes in the logarithm, so you really can't see it except early on here. No. This is a mixed master solution calculated by a mixed master code with a numerical change of variables. So once you have a, so you can imagine a file of scale factors as a function of time, and then plus the spatial dependence that you put in to fake the false inhomogeneity that has been put in by hand, then C is a, which is the norm of the killing field in the U1 space language, then is a function of the scale factors and this fake spatial dependence. So it can be evaluated at any spatial point. Okay.
Our U1 code doesn't recognize homogeneity even if it's there.
So we're pretending that the homogeneous model is really a U1 model. Okay, so we're pretending, and we're trying to interpret the variables of the U1 model in terms of something that we understand, to try to see if we get the BKL behavior. You know, how would we know it if we had it? So this is the idea of how do we identify the behavior that these models are supposed to have. So here's how. So one of the variables, this variable C, tracks the largest of the logarithmic scale factors, and it has two kinds of bounces. One is the usual mixed master bounce, and the other is when one scale factor changes to another. Okay, so that's what we should see in the variable phi if we have local mixed master dynamics. Now, at several points in this graph, we see where the largest the smallest scale factor has started to grow and overcome the next smallest one. So there's an interchange in the role of the smallest scale factor. That, it turns out, is associated with our U1 variable Z, which rises only in that situation. Okay. So actually, these variables are a nice way to look at this type of dynamics, whatever you call it, because it has within it, well, it allows you to avoid figuring out which is the largest scale factor in these variables. It treats them all the same. And then it also has within it a signature for the end of an era, which the normal, usual description doesn't have.
The behavior of these variables between the bounces is a straight line. The code seems to be doing it very well for the beginning and the very end, but in the middle,
yeah, that has to do with the time variable choice. This is not the BKL time. And then finally, there's a sort of volume-like variable, lambda, which just decays. The other ones that I didn't show, X and omega, always stay sort of order unity and don't do any interesting kind of oscillations. All right, so to summarize, if we want to identify local mixmaster dynamics, the variable phi should oscillate, and since it's a different mixed master universe at different spatial points, we should have bounces at different times, at different places. Occasionally, Z should grow. Usually, it will decay monotonically. And then, in principle, we could do a detailed comparison with the bounce laws written in our variables, which I have, but I've decided to spare you. Okay, so now let's use our standard method of consistent potential approach for this model. So we're trying another way of looking at the model. This is the Hamiltonian whose variation gives Einstein's equations. Schematically, it contains several exponential terms, which you can analyze in the same way we did the Gaudi models. You can write down the same kind of velocity term dominated solution with these spatially dependent velocity like coefficients, so we have linear behavior. These guys are not too important. It's important to recognize that the Hamiltonian constraint plays a vital role because it restricts these velocity parameters in the limit. So in particular, there's a restriction on the sine of vz and v phi if we want to keep these exponential terms exponentially small if we were to conjecture that this system were velocity dominated. We'll see that that's inconsistent because while this term is okay with those two velocities positive, this one is not. And one of our terms will always grow. In particular, at every spatial point, we can set up a sort of local mini superspace, just as we did for the Gaudi models, and the variable phi will bounce between these two potentials, which is identically what it did for the homogeneous model. And the other thing is that you see that, in fact, the variable z comes into this exponential, that there's also an effect on the z momentum, which will, under certain circumstances, cause z to bounce, and those are precisely the ones that you need to get z to grow at the end of an era.
Can you summarize again? So we are talking about just one thing here now.
Right.
V1.
Right. Right.
And what are the variables? Because now I'm confused at this stage.
Okay. Phi is the.
Like they are the norm.
Either the phi is the norm or the killing field. This one. In the exponent. Either the phi is, or either the two phi is the norm or the killing field. Z and X are variables involved in the two metric in the other two directions. Omega is the potential for the twist variables, which is sort of the off-diagonal between the killing direction and the other two directions. And lambda is the conformal factor in the plane, in the directions normal to the killing direction. That's right. That the system's not velocity dominated. That doesn't prove that it's really mixed master, but we're getting the behavior that we expect the BKLB hit. And in principle, if we had good enough numerical simulations, we could do a quantitative analysis because we now know what to look for. So at every spatial point, or at a typical spatial point in a U1 simulation of the full Einstein equation, so there's no approximations here, we see exactly that. So these are oscillations in phi. Again, we see we don't get all that many bounces. This is the same sort of behavior. It takes longer between bounces. These are the two potentials, each growing to create a bounce.
Wait a minute. You said before that it takes longer by factor of the next...
Roughly. Within an era the subunit, they get longer, but when you go to the next era, you sort of grow exponentially. So So the law is a law for the one. There's a scaling in the map for what's essentially the log of the volume from one epoch to the next, and that scaling is exponential. And I don't. So that's where it is. It's in there. And I mean, I have a way of explaining it, but it would take me a half hour.
But roughly the length in tau is what multiplied by 2, 3, something like that.
I don't
that
know.
But the delta tau, the next delta tau is a factor.
That's right. It's a factor, but I don't remember right now what the detail.
It's not 10, right? This is pure 10.
Well, let me say it a different way. In terms of the log of the volume, which is not tau, in order to get 20 or 30 bounces, you have to go to that number, a value of about 10 to the 7th or 10 to the 8th. To get 250 bounces, you have to go to 10 to the 62. For omega, which is the log of the volume, so it's 10 e to the 10 to the 62 e foldings in the volume to produce 250 bounces. To produce 30, you only have to go e to the 10 to the 7th. But we can't do either of those in these simulations, so that we only get a few bounces. So after the interval between the bounces increases, and there's a paper by the first author, I think Kolatnikov was the first author, with Sinai and a bunch of like that, where they actually looked at the statistics of the duration of the bounces. But anyway, it is part of the BKL map is a scaling for the essentially the volume at the end of one era to the volume at epoch to the end of the volume at the next. Okay, so this is what phi does. This is what, and I mean, it's this feature here, this sort of lengthening, which is not which just gets worse and worse as you go on. Okay, and this is what Z does. We don't see a rise in Z, except this one doesn't count. And then lambda decreases monotonically. And if we look at what we would see in the same situation for our homogeneous mixmaster, the pictures look very similar, especially if we look away from a Z bounce. And then what I'm going to show you here is the evolution of phi for typical initial data. The pattern that survives is left over from the initial conditions. This is the scale. And you can see in different places, it'll switch between red and blue. The inward and outward moving features are bounces occurring at different places at different times. I'll show you another movie for different initial data in a second. So what about these Z bounces? Well, the problem is you don't have them going on all the time the way you have the phi bounces. And right now we can't really, I've tried running longer but haven't seen one in most simulations. But with luck, it may be possible to actually get one early on somewhere in the spatial grid. And this is an example of one which hasn't been confirmed. The problem with confirming it is this spike here gets sharper at higher resolutions. And I have, in order to do a higher resolution simulation, I have to sort of start from this point, and I just haven't done it yet. But anyway, here's a couple of bounces in Z. Now, why would we get a couple? Well, the rules for when you get era changes show that it's actually more likely to get ones close together. That just means the integer part initially is less than 1.5. It is 1, that's right. And if it's less than, if it's between 1.5 and 2, you get more than one bounce. So this is the initial data that produced that feature. Now, what you're going to see a sort of blobby thing right away. That's the big spike. And then it's going to settle down and bounce around. But this one's going to have a lot more action than the other one. So these are lots of bounces occurring at different places at different times. These purple regions, which are down here, are growing because I put a cutoff to get the dynamic range in the early part of the simulation. And if you'll remember from the homogeneous models, the scale keeps going to larger negative numbers.
Just in the plotting, right?
Just in the plotting. Okay, just to get the dynamical range. So in other words, this isn't a constant. There's structure in there where it's just not showing. Now, I want to...
Phi.
No. That's right. And okay. But of course, we run for a short time in this language. Okay, this next movie, I want to run the first few frames separately. Otherwise, it'll go too fast for you to see something. But if I slowed it down for the whole movie, then we'd be here all day. So I'm going to run this one frame at a time because I want you to watch for a red dot to appear around there. And that will be the Z bounce. See it here coming up? And then that's going to go away. Okay. Now I'm going to show you the whole movie. And you watch, there it is, and it goes away. If you look carefully, you'll see another Z bounce come out there and go away, and then it's going to come back again. And this region here, again, is a cutoff in the plotting. In most of the spatial grid, Z is going to large negative values. And there's structure in there. It does not seem to come back. When it comes back of order unity, at least for the first few bounces. As the simulation goes on, you may have to lower this number a bit, but most of the stuff that's down here is down like minus 100 or 150 now. And it eventually it will come back. Right. Okay, so the last thing I want to talk about are numerical issues in the U1 models. We can solve the constraints initially with an algebraic ansatz. We actually know how to do a little better, but they haven't given any results that we haven't gotten this way. We have to enforce the Hamiltonian constraint at every time step for correct qualitative behavior. Again, for the reason that otherwise the relationship among those momenta is wrong. We use spatial averaging, which is a type of dissipation put into the code for stability. And then we have spiky features just like in Gaudi, and we get some funny convergence results. I'll show you. Okay, so these are the constraints. The Hamiltonian constraint was that messy Hamiltonian I wrote down, set equal to zero. The momentum constraints have a messy piece and then some fairly simple pieces. Because this part is linear in these momenta, there's an algebraic way Vince thought of to impose the constraints, which is this. We set a bunch of things equal to zero, then there's an ansatz for p lambda, and then we can go back and solve the Hamiltonian constraint for one of the remaining momenta, and we have four free functions, which should make these generic models. Okay, now this is a typical set of constraints, so we're evolving to tau equal 50, starting out at tau equal 20. The Hamiltonian constraint in blue does seem to converge at the proper rate. It should be second order. Now, when I'm solving the Hamiltonian constraint explicitly, why shouldn't it just be zero all the time? The answer is that the spatial averaging is a separate step, and that makes it non-zero again. And so, so this is encouraging. On the other hand, we're not doing too well here with the momentum constraints, which seem to be anti-converging. This is, I believe, the value, either the average or the maximum. It's not a norm, and it's responding to spiky features that are narrower and sharper at the higher resolution. Yeah. Right.
So this just shows that how you evaluate the constraint and how you solve the constraint, that these two samples are consistent.
That's probably true. Yeah, it sort of settles out. The conclusion from this is that we're letting the momentum constraint run free. One thing it's saying is that there are features that we're not resolving properly, is what it's saying. Okay, but I don't want it. We're running toward the singularity. On the other hand, the time evolution at a given spatial point shows the same qualitative features independent of resolution. So if we're asking qualitative questions, as we are, I think we are getting that behavior correctly. It's not even the same spatial point. Okay? It's just to show that the same qualitative behavior expected from the local BKL behavior is independent of resolution. And this shows the evolution. As a function of grid size. And so you see the difference. The features are get narrower at higher resolution. On the other hand, you can see that we're reproducing the same qualitative behavior.
Can you use the best of grids to try to resolve the
problem? No. One could.
No, yeah.
But I'm not. Okay, this shows the behavior of this variable as a function of resolution, giving a hint of what comes out correctly and what comes out wrong. So the magnitude is about right. This looks very similar to the plots that I showed you for Gaudi wave amplitude as a function of resolution, and it's doing that for approximately the same reason. It also shows that at every spatial point, the interplay between the two potentials and the variable phi is correct. Now, the final numerical thing I want to talk about is something we mentioned last week due to Vince, and that's this energy constructed from the constraints. That's this quantity whose derivative satisfies this equation. If the constraints are satisfied, then this doesn't say anything. But if numerically they're violated, we find that the coefficient depends on the sign of the lapse. And what this suggests is running toward the singularity with lapses positive in our variables, we get an instability due to constraint violation, whereas running in the other direction, we should at least not get this instability. Okay, this doesn't rule out all instabilities, but it suggests that it's better to run that way. And the idea then, the difficulty in testing this so far has been to get the right kind of initial data. If one takes just initial data such as I described before, then there's too much initial nonlinear sloshing around for this to be helpful. On the other hand, if we run toward the singularity and use a final state as initial data and run the other way, it does seem to run more stably. On the other hand, one thing it does is provide confirmation in some sense of our previous runs. This is a spatial slice of the variable phi run expanding direction from the final state of a run toward the singularity. So running toward the singularity, we had to use this averaging to get stability. So this is replacing each variable by its average over a stencil at every time step. And so what you're going to see, and you'll see which one is which very easily, is that the average, in fact, follows the unaveraged behavior qualitatively. So the red is the average and the blue is the unaveraged. And because of all these spiky features in the unaveraged value of, at a rather small spatial resolution, I'm not prepared to say which one is more correct. Right. Right. Yeah, with the unaverage, we come very close. I do have a picture I can show you. I didn't put it in there.
The unaverage total is time for machine accuracy, time reversal, so it should reproduce the machine accuracy.
Right. Okay. So finally, I just have some concluding remarks. Our simulations, plus mathematical studies, of course, seem to provide strong support for the initial BKL picture. Our method of consistent potentials allows us to predict the nature of the approach to the singularity in complicated models, and it says a little more than the just the BKL picture or even the mathematical studies. It shows the mechanism operating in the singularity, in the approach to the singularity. And then cosmological spacetimes may serve as numerical laboratories. Now there's some open questions. There are probably ones other than these, but here are some we've talked about. How do our results depend on the spacetime slicing? We've used the harmonic gauge condition. The information we have so far, though, is that we have two completely different pictures of the homogeneous Bianchi 9 model as a U1 and the mini superspace picture, or the original BKL variables. They all give the same prediction for the same reason. That is, if you assume a Kasner behavior, you find out that it's inconsistent. Then is the BKL picture, in fact, the entire story? This requires precise numerical study of the oscillations to see if what the departures are, you know, whether they're just because we can't run far enough, we can understand that, or whether something else is coming in. And then there's the issue of what about other topologies, other boundary conditions, such as the singularity in the collapse in the interior of a black hole. So the information we have on that is that early in the simulation, there's some effect due to global boundary conditions. Later in the simulation, the behavior is local. And future directions, well, one is doing better numerics, adding matter. Alan and I have talked about some Einstein-Glasov, at least for homogeneous models so far. I've played around with the scalar field in these models. Going to 3D, if the local behavior is in fact characteristic, which we certainly now know it is generically, with a scalar field to suppress oscillations, then we don't need a lot of spatial resolution to study such systems. And then in the expanding direction, including matter, one has a model for the code to simulate the interactions of nonlinear gravitational waves and matter in the early universe. Thank you. Yeah, it would. Right. Right, and those are non-single. Right, I'm sorry.
Well, sums up because you're mentioning these potentials where you could get velocity-dominated behavior with a subset, which we, two subsets, which we call half-polarized, which are hooked up to kill either one of those, one or the other of those two potentials asymptotically, so they don't bounce off of it. And that's,
right.
You can use the Rendell Pitcher Masami methods to sort of rigorously.
That's right. That's right.
So, the observation
you get
definitely can be sort of clearly identified as being real rather than just being.
Oh, that's right. If you put in a scalar field, you can clearly correlate how long it takes the oscillations to die out with the strength of the scalar field. The stronger the scalar field, the faster the oscillations are suppressed.
The bounces somehow depend on the spatial derivatives at the corresponding
right.
point, but those themselves are evolving because
right.
of inhomogeneous.
Right.
Somehow I have a feeling, maybe Ellen or others could correct, there probably won't be some universal set of ODEs that can tell us what's going on at a generic spatial point.
You should be able to bound or look at the time, the rate of change of the coefficients compared to the exponential behavior of the potentials, and use that somehow as the basis of some mathematical statement that.
Finally, you're supposed to be in the various parts of the curvature. And
what I think happens is that although here I'm saying the time part of the curvature is the time that it is into some time direction in the curve. The space part finally rises up to the same level always. So it would be interesting to see that there are several components of curvature which evolve in time and you see these boundaries. And then increasing to infinity. Finally, I think it's a turbulent in the sense that space is as full of space as time. And then we see that there are no universal rules. Finally, because when you try to go somewhere, space is given final.
What you have, we talked about the Bell Robinson energy at some point and tried to follow that, so you must have hidden away in your desk.
Yeah.
So the calculation of electromagnetic stuff on one problem, so we can kind of pull that out. And
I don't have it with me. Yeah, I'm not sure we can follow it long enough to see the spatial derivatives come back and or the limited resolution. But yes, certainly something we can do. Yeah. Right. Right, right. Yeah. Well, I think he would need some adaptive mesh. Yeah.
I'm trying to confront problems. In Europe, about 15 years ago, Roger O'Leary had written a U1 code when he was at Yale that solved the constraints on each or at least every few time steps. So it sort of killed off this problem. The constraints running away. Of course, since he had to solve the Lipschitz equations and since the computers were so much slower, I don't think he ever got to see any mismatch type oscillations. We're not set up to resolve the constraints in a practical way because we're not in a CNC slicing situation. So, you have to pay the price for whatever you want to do. I mean, I just wonder, if you thought, suppose you did try to, would it be practical today to try to run a fully constrained code in another gauge for the fact that we solve the constraints and solve them every few time steps or something.
Well,
see far enough to get an oscillation.
I think if you could, if it would be legitimate to solve constraints linearized about your previous value for the...
So you didn't have to solve those narrows.
Right. Yeah, so you were solving linear elliptic equations at every time step. I think in 2D
that would be
feasible. I don't know if my colleagues agree with that.
I don't see a problem even with Naaman.
Even with Naaman? Yeah, I know, and his is really inching along there. Well, that would be certainly doable to compare whether there's a difference or not, because you could take something that runs for 5 minutes as a hyperbolic code and run it as a constrained code. Yeah. Well, with very low resolution, but you could see if what difference solving the constraints made. I mean, that would certainly show up at that point. That would tell you whether it was worthwhile making some major effort to speed up the constraints or something.
Yeah, they wouldn't have to solve them every time, so if it was every 5 times, they
yeah.
Like for 5 or something like that over Peter's 5
right.
10 or 100.
What's
the state of play? Do you have 3D calculations?
Hmm?
3D calculations?
Yes, what's what about them?
What's the state of play?
Oh, where are we?
Yeah.
Well, Vince wrote the equations down. In our variables in 1981 or something. But we haven't made any progress yet. It's not clear to me. I mean, we could just take some old 3D code and put on periodic boundary conditions and see. Well, I think 100 cubed would be enough.
Yeah, but if you say you can only for 500.
Oh, that's just because I'm lazy. I could do more.
Yeah.
I don't think so. But it's just the question, what are you... You can just... you can take... In our variables, the difference between 2D and 3D is that we have to keep the two twist variables and can't make the transformation to the twist potential. But otherwise, everything is the same. I mean, plus modulo everything getting worse because you have 3 dimensions. It's not clear that those variables are particularly advantageous in the generic case. Do we want to worry about? Huh? That's right. That's what I'm saying, that it's not clear. I mean, we could certainly, there's no problem with using them even if the symmetry isn't there, but on the other hand, we could take some others 3D code that already exists and is solving Einstein's equations and just put on periodic boundary conditions to do collapsing models in T3, but then, we have to figure out how to interpret the results. And then there's black hole formation, which would be an issue. The Hamiltonian.
Yeah, and the point is, you can do it in a way that sort of the 3D problem contains the 2D
right.
problem and the special case modulo issue of the twist potential, and the 2D problem contains the 1D problem and the special case of gauge conditions. And so you have a nice set of code tests that you could imagine doing if we ever get around it.
Right.
I'm not sure that's the right way to go, though, because maybe we'll want to thinking about enforcing the constraints. They're running away pretty bad now. Mm-hmm. Worse than the previous. That point you mentioned about the norm of it, the L2 norm of the constraints, mm-hmm. and being set, I've made this point a couple of times before, but I think that's one of the advantages of Peter's setup, that he's kind of in the same situation as we are when we're running in the expanding direction. You have a good term trying to help us.
Yeah.
Normal constraints die back down again if it starts to grow, and since empirically he sees I think possibly due to that stabilizing term.